This is Focus. Good morning. Welcome to hour number two of the program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Harriet Williamson is the producer. Jason Croft is at the controls. Kyle Mabry was on for hour number one. The drug Vioxx was introduced in 1999 and quickly became a very widely used painkiller. But as early as 2000, there were concerns about the safety of this medication, specifically about increased risk of heart attack and stroke in people taking it. And it has been estimated that this drug to date has caused as many as 140,000 cases of heart disease and may have led to the deaths of as many as 56,000 people. Concerns over the safety of Vioxx led the manufacturer to pull the drug from the market in 2004, but at that time, many people argued that that action was late in coming and that even then there had been ample evidence of the risks of Vioxx. In this hour of the show, we have as our guest journalist Snigdha Prakash. She is author of a recent book that's titled All the Justice Money Can Buy, and this book tells the story of one of the first Vioxx cases to go to trial. It took place in Texas in summer of 2005. The result was, at least in one particular case, was a very large damage award for the plaintiff in the case. If you'd like to read the book, you can certainly seek it out. And in fact, she's here to give a talk and will be doing a book signing. The signing is this afternoon at 12:30, taking place at the Illini Union Bookstore on South Wright in Champaign on the campus. And then she's giving a talk in the MillerCom series, and that will take place this afternoon at 4 o'clock in the Knight Auditorium. That's in the Spurlock Museum on the campus. These are always open and free, so anybody who would like to attend should feel welcome. And on this program, questions are welcome too. And you can call in if you'd like to do that. Our local number is 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line that is good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. And if you would like to send an email, you may do that as well. And that's will-talk@illinois.edu. So at any point here, people want to be involved in the conversation, they can certainly do that. Well, thank you very much for being here.
It's my pleasure.
We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
There's much here that we can talk about. Maybe it might be good just to go back and to talk about how at one time how widely used this medicine was, not only in the United States but all over the world. Millions of people took this drug.
Yes, by Merck's own estimate, some 20 million Americans had used Vioxx. By the time it was withdrawn in 2004, there were millions more around the world. And it was given for, you know, everything from arthritis pain, you know, the aches and pains of getting old, to rheumatoid arthritis. It was given in post-operatic and surgery settings for acute pain. It was prescribed, I know, so many people who took it for tennis elbow. So it was very widely used. Merck was hoping to make it the number one painkiller in the country because the painkiller market is big. It was heavily advertised. Merck actually spent more on advertising it than Pepsi and I think Budweiser combined. So I mean it was a major consumer product.
Mm-hmm. And Merck made an awful lot of money off of selling this medicine as well.
Yes, they did. They sold billions and billions of dollars worth. The sales the year before it was withdrawn, so in 2003, were close to $3 billion. It was something closer to $2.5 billion the year before and something like that the year before that. It was a very profitable drug, and it was a very important drug to Merck.
Mm-hmm. And when the drug was introduced, I think that at least the way it was promoted and the way that people thought about it, it was sort of nothing short of miraculous because it had the qualities of these anti-inflammatory pain relievers but didn't have one side effect, which was stomach bleeding, and that was always a problem with these kind of medications. And so when this was introduced, the big thing was that it has the pain reliever, the anti-inflammatory effect, but doesn't cause this other problem.
That's right. And what Merck had not known when it started developing Vioxx in the early 90s was that the two enzymes, let's back up a minute and say that what Vioxx did was it controlled inflammation by blocking what is called the COX-2 enzyme. Unlike the older drugs, Advil, Aleve, the older non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, Vioxx did not block the COX-1 enzyme, which regulates the mucus lining of the digestive system. The older drugs, because they blocked it, they interfered with how the body maintains that mucus lining, and that's why people would get irritation and, in severe cases, bleeds and ulcers. Now, Vioxx blocked COX-2, so it blocked the pain enzyme, but it didn't block the stomach enzyme, the stomach protection enzyme. What Merck had not known when it was developing the drug was that COX-1 and COX-2 play a really vital complementary role in maintaining the vascular health and maintaining the flow of blood in through the blood vessels. And that is how they were led astray. Mm. They did learn along the way. There were plenty of signs that pointed to the fact that COX-2, the enzyme that Vioxx blocked, also regulated the production of a molecule called prostacycline, which happens to be the most potent defense against heart attacks in the body. You can think of it as a molecule that sort of calms the platelets, calms the blood, keeps the blood flowing. Mm-hmm. And COX-1 is an anti... COX-1 produces thromboxane, which promotes clotting. So the older drugs, which blocked both COX-1 and COX-2, blocked both the thromboxane and the prostacycline, so they didn't really have too much of an effect. But you block one and without blocking the other, you got a problem.
Yeah. I suppose the big question here, certainly one of the big questions that it would have come up in lawsuits was, at what point did the manufacturer of the drug realize that it had this harmful potential?
Well, if you're Merck, you say, we didn't know until this big study in 2004 that we saw the results, we acted immediately, it was the first definitive evidence, and we pulled the drug. Hmm. What else do you want us to do? If you're the plaintiff, you look at what Merck was doing in the years preceding that study, and you say, well, what about this, this, and this? There were lots of other studies, Merck's own studies, that pointed to risks, and that Merck spun the data, they hid the data, they misrepresented the data, and they didn't tell doctors and patients. They knew, but they didn't tell. And that's really the question that's at the center of these cases.
Yeah. So as you say, when Merck finally pulled the drug from the market in 2004, it was because of one of their own studies that showed this increased risk, but that at the same time, there were people who were arguing that as early, even when the drug was still in development, as early as the late 90s, there were people at Merck who were concerned about this serious potential side effect.
Well, Merck funded some research in the late 90s that suggested what we were talking about earlier, which is that the COX-2 enzyme regulates prostacycline, the blood calming molecule. And there were questions, there were concerns raised about upsetting the balance between thromboxane, the pro-platelet molecule, and prostacycline, the anti-clotting molecule. In fact, Merck's outside board of scientific advisors, drawn from, you know, best universities in the country, and in fact, outside the country, came to Merck and said, you really should do a study because it's going to be a big drug. You need to find out whether it causes heart attacks or alternatively. At that time, there was a big group of people who thought that inflammation was an important, I don't even know what the right word is, but it played an important role in heart disease.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that anti-inflammatories such as Vioxx may play a role in combating.
Might actually help.
Right,
yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So when you say Merck had known for a while, that was the first that it, that, you know, sort of solid question mark that was put up against Vioxx, you know. Maybe it's going to cause a problem.
Yeah. I think when you plunged into this and ended up learning probably more than you ever had known about at least this aspect of health and the drug business, I don't think that you had spent a lot of time either doing reporting, doing health reporting, or really doing reporting on the pharmaceutical industry, had you?
No, I'm not a science reporter. And anyone who has a science background can probably tell that as I try and explain the COX-1, COX-2 balance here. I actually, to the extent that I had a background, it was in business journalism. I was a reporter at a paper called The American Banker, which was a banking newspaper. And when I came to NPR first, I was mostly doing business stories. But at some point, I started doing stories on the intersection of business and science. And there's no way really to understand the pharmaceutical industry and to report on the business of the pharmaceutical industry without getting into the science of it. And that's, I count myself as very fortunate that many, that I had many good teachers, some of the best cardiologists in the country got involved in the Vioxx issue and were very kind, spent a lot of time explaining basic science to me.
Our guest in this hour of Focus is Snigdha Prakash. She's been a journalist for a number of years. Most recently, she was a reporter for National Public Radio. That's between 1998 and 2007, where she spent a lot of her time following this particular story. And she tells the story of one of the early cases to go to trial for people who had alleged that they or someone close to them was injured as a result of taking this medicine, Vioxx. Her book is All the Justice Money Can Buy, Corporate Greed on Trial. That's the subtitle. The book is out now, and Kaplan Publishing is the publisher. She's here to give a talk, and we'll be doing a book signing as well this afternoon on the campus. I'll tell you again a little bit more about that later. Questions are welcome. We do have somebody here who is ready to go. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. And here is a caller in Champaign, line number one.
Oh, yes. I was wondering, given your expertise, if you might have an opinion on the follow-up to Vioxx, which is that shortly after Merck removed Vioxx from the market because of the problems you're indicating, all of a sudden, out of nowhere, they announced that this new drug they had developed, Gardasil, was so successful that they were terminating all further clinical trials and immediately rushing it into the market. And as of today, as you know, Merck is pushing Gardasil on young girls all over the country. I saw an article in the Chicago Tribune that as of today, maybe 40% of all young girls in America have gone through the Merck Gardasil sequence. And they're now trying to push it on young boys. And this despite the fact that Judicial Watch, which is a very conservative legal organization, has blown the whistle on the dangers of Gardasil on their website. And I guess I'm concerned that the more this Gardasil goes on, the more we are going to see a repeat of Vioxx by the exact same people trying to make profits. And in this community, I go over there to Carl Clinic and talking with doctors there, I get the distinct impression that Carl Clinic is pushing Gardasil on all the young girls in this town, which also raises the question, you're talking about the economics here. You know, how much does Carl Clinic and the doctors at Carl get from Merck and other drug companies to push these dangerous vaccines on people. So I'd be interested in your comment reaction to that. Thank you.
All right. Well, this is a completely different drug and a completely different issue. This is the caller is talking about the drug that is a vaccine against the human papilloma virus, which has been implicated in cancer of the cervix and a number of other cancers. And now I do believe that within the medical profession, it has been widely recommended that girls and boys get it. I think the American Academy of Pediatrics and the American Academy of Obstetrics and Gynecology have come out and said, yes, they think that it should be given. So I don't know if you have anything to say about this.
Well, I'll say a couple of things. As you say, this is a very different issue, and vaccines are, you know, people have very strong opinions about the safety of vaccines and whether they're a good thing or a bad thing. It is true that most medical organizations with something to say about this have come out in support of it. Separately, though, I would say, I am in no way saying the vaccine is dangerous, that as the Republican presidential candidate said, perhaps it causes mental retardation. I mean, I don't think there's any, at least I am not aware of any science to back that up. What I will say as a reporter is that Merck's campaign to push the vaccine, to encourage states, state governments, state governors, and even health organizations to get behind the vaccine. You know, it's a case study in how the company works and how pharmaceutical companies build markets. And it's interesting, but I probably don't have the expertise to get into the debate.
Yeah. Well, again, our guest this morning is a journalist, Snigdha Prakash, and she's written a book about Vioxx. And about one of the very first cases to go to trial, where there was the allegation that it had harmed someone. And in fact, the particular case that we'll maybe talk a little bit about has to do with a woman who sued the company after her husband died of a heart attack, and she and her attorneys were arguing that it was because of Vioxx, and it was one of how many lawsuits now have there been filed over Vioxx?
So just a little history.
Yeah.
There were, I think the numbers are like 40,000 lawsuits that were filed, and there were more that would have been filed in, but the plaintiffs decided not to file them. They were waiting to see how Merck would handle the claims. And in 2007, Merck, in fact, did announce a settlement for about $5 billion for most of the heart attack claims. Mm-hmm. And a good chunk of that money over time has been paid out. There are questions about, you know, how much did the plaintiffs get? Does it really compensate them for the injuries they suffered? And is $5 billion just a drop in the bucket for a company like Merck?
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the questions here, I suppose, and I'm sure that the company, when it was when someone came along and said that they believed that they or someone had been harmed by taking the drug, I'm sure that and if we were talking about heart attack, I'm sure that the company would have said something like, "Look, heart attack is the leading cause of death in this country." And that it may, in fact, be that some of these people who suffered heart attacks had other complicating risk factors. So how does one say, if you're a plaintiff in a case like this and you're trying to make the argument that the heart attack was caused by the medicine, how do you establish that? How in the case that you looked at? How did the attorneys try to establish this causal relationship?
So it's hard. And in fact, it was Merck's best defense. Mm-hmm. You know, in every case that was tried, they said some version of what I'm about to say to you, which is, you know, there are a million heart attacks a year in America. They happen because of, you know, how we live. We're sedentary. We don't eat well. Maybe you have genetic factors. We get old. You know, it's all too bad, but we're not responsible for it. And there's nothing you're going to be able to, there's no way you're going to be able to look at a heart attack and say, oh, Vioxx caused that. There are five other reasons why it happened. Here's why that thinking is a little bit faulty and what the lawyer in this case tried to do when he presented the case to the jury. There are many factors that contribute to a heart attack. But what scientists have now decided is that Vioxx, by raising the risk broadly, globally, was making it like even more likely that people at high risk would have heart attacks. In fact, Vioxx, I'll state it differently, Vioxx was the riskiest for people who were already at high risk of heart attacks. Those were the last people who should have been on the drug. Mm-hmm. And the point isn't, does this person have high blood pressure or high cholesterol, and is that why they had a heart attack? The question really is, if they have all these risk factors, why are they on a drug that raises the risk of heart attack?
Hmm. So this is it's obviously a very big and complicated story. And for the book, All the Justice Money Can Buy, you chose to concentrate primarily on this one particular case.
Yes, let me tell you about that.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, do that.
Yeah. So this is a case that was tried actually in New Jersey State Court in Atlantic City. There were two plaintiffs involved in it. One was a man who was in his late 50s when he had a heart attack. Very healthy man, very active. He was a Vietnam vet who came back with an injury. He lived with pain all his life. Then he worked for the post office. He had an injury that he was prescribed Vioxx for, and out of the blue, he had a heart attack. The second plaintiff was the estate of a man who died also. Actually, this man was in his 40s. He died suddenly. Mm-hmm. He had been taking Vioxx for a bum knee that came from years and years and years of playing basketball, as I recall. So there were two cases that were being tried together. And the reason I was interested in this trial was because of who was trying the cases, who the plaintiff's mm-hmm. lawyer was. He was the man who tried the first Vioxx case in Texas. Mark Lanier was his name. He's arguably one of the best trial lawyers working in the country, one of the best trial lawyers of his generation. He's charismatic. He's brilliant. He works really hard. He is just, I mean, he's unbelievably good. And he had tried the case in Texas where Merck got a judgment of almost $250 million against it that in fact the Supreme Court of Texas overturned after a period of several years. And he was just really good. And I said to him, you know, how do you keep winning these cases? He said, well, come and see. And so I was embedded in the trial. I was not a member of his team, but I had observer status in the team. And I got to see how they made the sausage.
Yeah. Okay. So I guess I'm getting confused. I'm getting confused between cases that this particular lawyer tried, and I guess that's why I was really thinking about the case, the Ernst family case, which I think was in fact the first one, and
right.
that was Texas. Right.
Right.
And that
right.
was the one that was the $235 million.
And it's what judgment. It's yeah. It's I think it was. Yeah, it was a little bit more than that. But it's what Mark Lanier is known for. And it's how Vioxx, you know, the Vioxx litigation really came to the news. It's, a lot of people remember that case, and so it's not surprising that you would think of him in that context.
Well, that's for a reporter. This isn't a very not the kind of opportunity that comes along every day. So it's understandable why you would say, well, yes, of course, that you would take the opportunity to be there and be behind the scenes and then be able to write this. What was in it for him? It was, I suppose, some people in a cynical way would say, well, this was just about self-promotion as far as he was concerned. And maybe at that point, though, he was so well known, he would not have needed to do something like that.
Oh, I don't think there's any ounce of Mark that would not have wanted self-promotion. I mean, I don't think there's any self-promotion Mark has ever met that he doesn't like. And I say this, I like him enormously, but as I hope the book shows, you know, he's a human being. He's got his flaws. And of course he wanted to present his side of the story. And of course he's interested in promoting himself. He's a, you know, big time plaintiff's lawyer. Of course he wanted something from it. And it was my job to go there and try and get what I wanted from it and not give the store away.
Yeah. Now, I guess there has been also some criticism of the book because there are people who say that somehow you should have made more of an effort to reflect the company's point of view.
Really? There's been criticism? It's the first time hearing of it. Well, yes. But, you know, if the company, I asked Merck when I came back from the trial and they said, well, hey, what can we do to help? And I said, well, you know, you could put me on one of your teams and I could see how the other side does it. Then I would have a really balanced account. And the person I talked to, who was sort of the head of their PR for the litigation, said, you know, he laughed and he said, that's not going to happen. Like, oh, what a joke, right? Mm-hmm. You know, and I know it's not going to happen. Mm-hmm. What I did have, though, were extensive public records. The case had been tried many times in many courts. The science involved in the case has been studied extensively, and cardiologists and clinical trialists have published on this in the best journals in the country. I'd reported on this for a long time. I had a lot of people, you know, who were willing to lend their expertise, and I think I have done a pretty good job of presenting Merck's point of view. What I didn't have was the opportunity to get to know the Merck team in the way that I got to know the plaintiff's team and, you know, build relationships with them and be able to give some insight from that point of view.
Yeah. Our guest in this part of Focus is Snigdha Prakash. She's a journalist, was for a number of years a reporter for National Public Radio, and is the author of a recently published book, All the Justice Money Can Buy, about one of the early cases against Merck, the manufacturer of Vioxx. She's here to give a talk. We'll talk some more with her in just a moment. First, though, we have to take a short break. This is Focus.
On the next Fresh Air, we discuss the early history of the birth control movement with Jill Lepore. She says it's easy to think the politics surrounding the issue have always been the same as now, but
the arguments made by one side or the other have kind of switched sides over time more than once.
Lepore writes about the history of Planned Parenthood in the current edition of The New Yorker. Join us.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
WILL programs are made possible by Bevere Cafe. Bevere Cafe offers specialty coffees, breakfast featuring a choice of cold and hot breakfast items from 8 a.m. to 11 a.m., and to-go sandwiches and salads for lunch. Bevere Cafe is student-operated in Bevere Hall, corner of Gregory and Goodwin, Urbana.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're here weekday mornings with 10 different topics. Tomorrow morning in the 10 o'clock hour, our guest will be Eileen Schwartz. She is a professor in the College of Education at the University of Washington, and she'll be here visiting the campus to talk about some of the work that she has done in working with children with autism. And she's had a lot of success, and so she will tell us about that tomorrow. Also tomorrow, we will talk with Nicholas DeMonchot. He is a professor of architecture in the College of Design at University of California, Berkeley, and has written a very interesting book about how it is that the spacesuits that the Apollo astronauts wore were designed and made. And he says, well, you know, once we made the decision to go to the moon, then we had to develop all kinds of things to get the men there. And it's a very interesting story that brings the fashion business in, because amazingly enough, the spacesuits that the astronauts wore were made by the Playtex Corporation and were sewn by the seamstresses of Playtex, the same ones who are known for women's foundation garments. It's a very interesting story, and he'll be talking with us tomorrow in the 11 o'clock hour. We're here weekday mornings from 10 to noon, 10 different topics every week. You can have a look at the schedule by going to our website, which is WILL.illinois.edu. And again, our guest in this hour is Snigdha Prakash. Her book is All the Justice Money Can Buy, Corporate Greed on Trial, and it is published by Kaplan Publishing. She's on the campus to give a talk and to give a book signing. She will be doing a signing today at 12:30 on the campus in the Illini Union Bookstore. This is on South Wright. And she will also be a guest speaker in the MillerCom series, speech on the topic drugs, death, and dollars inside the court battle over a lethal painkiller. That's the same subject we're talking about here this morning. This is open to the public. Anybody who would want to attend should feel welcome. And that's at 4 o'clock this afternoon in the Knight Auditorium of the Spurlock Museum. So you can stop by. And questions here, welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, we have you here in the studio, and I'd like to give people an opportunity when they're here, right off their, when they're here, to maybe do a little bit of reading from the work. So maybe you'd like to read something out of All the Justice Money Can Buy.
I would love to. I'm reading you an excerpt from a chapter called The Perfect Goober. It's the opening examination of that Mark Lanier did. It's his first witness. And the perfect goober is Mark Lanier's term for the president of Merck. So here's a little background. Mark likes to open his cases with hostile witnesses. When I asked his jury consultant, Bob Leone, about that after the trial, I said, you know, why do you do it? Why don't you start with a pliable witness? You know, they can present your side of the case. Why start with someone who's going to fight you all the way? Bob said, well, you know, Mark's great gift is cross-examination. He's really good at taking people apart and puts us all in a good mood, and we like to do it, you know, to start the case. And Anstis, he's the perfect goober to do it too. So, to give you a flavor of the trial, I will read you a section that talks about the first 15, 20 minutes of the case. The jury had been waiting in an anteroom for almost an hour by the time Higby asked Lanier to begin. Your Honor, as our first witness, we are going to call the Merck gentleman, Mr. David Anstis, Lanier said, pointing to where a tall, balding man with a long, angular face sat on the Merck side of the courtroom. David Anstis walked briskly to the witness stand, raised his right hand somewhat theatrically, and took the oath. Good morning, Mr. Anstis, Lanier said, walking toward him, hand extended. Mark Lanier. Good morning, Anstis replied, standing up from the seat he had just taken to shake Lanier's hand. He looked genuinely pleased at the gesture. Perhaps Lanier was glad to see him again? In fairness to the jury, this is not my first time to question you. I think this is my third. Is that about right? Lanier continued. That's about right, Anstis said loudly, catching Lanier's drift. The handshake hadn't been a social courtesy, but rather the opening shot in the day's battle. Already, I thought, Lanier had seized the high ground with his friendly greeting and its multiple messages to the jury. Merck has faced lots of Vioxx trials. I've tried many of those cases, and don't feel too sorry for Anstis. He's a pro at testifying. Besides, look how nicely I treat the man. Anstis took a large sip of water from the tiny, clear plastic Dixie cup provided by the state of New Jersey. The cup and the gesture looked wholly unequal to the job of steadying his nerves for what lay ahead. I asked Lanier about that handshake as I was writing this account. A little over 2 years had passed, but Lanier remembered the moment well, and a slow smile crossed his face as he explained why he'd offered his hand to Anstis that morning. First of all, I'm directing the action. I'm in charge, Lanier said. He can't ignore me. He can't look at my hand and snub me. Also, Lanier knew it rattled Anstice's lawyers. I have never seen another lawyer in 60 or 70 trials go up and shake their opponent's hand, he said. And I knew everything in them is saying, wait a minute, he can't do that. Objection, Your Honor, he's shaking his hand. So they're set on their heels. And Lanier said it was a ritual salute to his opponent. You know, before the sword fight, you bow before each other, then you turn around and take your paces back. It was Lanier's way of declaring, let the games begin. The man whom Leone considered the perfect goober to launch the plaintiff's case was dressed in full corporate regalia. A sharp blue suit, starched white shirt, and sober maroon tie. His hair was graying and cut short. He had a ruddy, pleasant face. It didn't advertise the drive and ambition its owner had doubtless needed to travel from the bottom of the globe to the very top ranks of a Fortune 500 company. But Anstice's origins were plain the moment he spoke. Despite years of living in the U.S., Anstice retained his distinctive Australian vowels. As he questioned Anstice, Lanier wrote on the oversized tablet facing the jury, first in block letters, David Anstice, and then, sprawling across the page, President, Human Health for the U.S. That was Anstice's title as Vioxx was under development and when it was first sold. It was the perfect setup for the routine Lanier had rehearsed in his suite that morning. I didn't hire you for that job, did I? Lanier said with a smile. No, you did not, Anstice said evenly. I'm not the one who went over your resume and decided whether or not I was going to make you president of human health of the United States of America, am I? Lanier said. He peered farsightedly at his hands in a parody of someone reading a resume, and he grinned widely. Anstice repeated patiently. No, Lanier had not hired him. You were hired by Merck, Lanier said. Yes, that's correct. Anstice said, the reason he was asking, Lanier said to Anstice, was that in her opening statement the day before, the Merck lawyer had suggested that he, Lanier, would question Anstice on matters related to science. Are you a science man? Lanier asked. No, I'm not a science person, Anstice replied. So as president of human health, Lanier said, pointing to his tablet where Anstice's title was now circled in bright red magic marker, you don't really know anything about human health, do you? Lanier said, no, that's not correct. All right. Do you know some stuff about human health? Is it okay for me to ask you health questions? Lanier sounded now like a parent humoring a difficult child. I'm not a scientist, but I do have a general understanding, Anstice said. If at some point I ask you questions that are outside your area, you just got to tell me. That's more science. I'm more a sales guy. Fair? Lanier said. Yes, I will tell you. If Lanier's strategy was to needle and provoke, Anstice's strategy was the reverse. He was trying to tamp down Lanier's high spirits with a kind of no-nonsense agreeableness that said, yes, yes, I know this is a show, now let's get on with it. Still, in just a few minutes, Lanier had managed to make Anstice look faintly ridiculous, and his touch had been as light as a feather. Anstice's lawyers sat quietly at their table, powerless to deflect Lanier's seemingly gentle barbs, at least for the moment.
That's very nice. And certainly what that shows, if people didn't understand it already, is that being an attorney in a case like this constitutes giving a performance.
It's all performance. It's not all performance, but it's a lot of performance.
A lot of performance. And yeah. He seems to be somebody who really is very good at connecting with juries. And it may be going into a case like this that juries are already, you know, maybe they're predisposed to think that the big business guys are the bad guys. And I'm going back to thinking of the Ernst trial. I think that after that juror said that they were really turned off by the way that the attorneys for the company treated
the widow,
that they really did not like. That and that that it was a particular case where people really, this guy, Lanier, people on the jury really connected with him and definitely did not with the company's attorneys. And that probably was the case all the way in this case, too.
Well, Lanier does a lot of research. He spends a lot of money. I mean, he has a fantastic jury consultant who helps him to understand the mindset of jurors in the particular place where he's trying the case. So jurors in New Jersey are very different from jurors in Texas. the sort of narrative that he puts around the Vioxx story then is adjusted for that. For, you know, in the Texas case that you've brought up, he presented the Vioxx story as a kind of CSI. He said, oh, someone here died. Your job is to find out who killed him. Right. Mm-hmm. And it was based on the fact that they'd done research. I mean, it's Texas. It's where they're from. It's outside Houston, not far from where they live. But the research showed that this was a pro-death penalty crowd, you know. And so they thought, you know, people are really going to respond to presenting this as a murder case. In New Jersey, where the sensibilities are different, they toned it down a great deal. As I describe in the book, the jury consultant Bob Leone explained to me, look, in New Jersey, they don't believe in the death penalty in the same way we do in Texas, but, you know, they believe in rules. And I thought if we can present the case in sort of as unemotional terms as we can, we'll talk about it as a traffic accident. You know, someone running a stoplight. No one likes people who run stop signs and cause death. Maybe then we can be at sort of at the right emotional wavelength for the New Jersey jurors. Yeah.
Well, I have some callers here. I want to make sure we get them. And we're now getting into about our last 10 minutes with Snigdha Prakash talking about her book, All the Justice Money Can Buy. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Here's some callers. We'll start us off again here with Champaign County, line one. Hello.
Hi. This hits me where I live because I was trying out Vioxx the very week that I guess you broke the story, or the story was broken. So I'm concerned about it. I don't want to stump you with the biochemistry of it. I don't understand it either. But you mentioned that the COX-1 and the COX-2 sort of interact together to produce this biochemical that's good for cardiac health. So what does that say about the COX-1 inhibitors as far as how much they interfere with the cardiac health? Can you say anything about that? I have another question. Maybe I'll just blurt it out and listen on the radio, which is, has Merck ever had to admit culpability in the sense of ignoring their own research? This implicates, you know, this proprietary aspect of pharmaceutical research, which I think is just, you know, absolutely disgusting. And a lot of university researchers participate in it, and it's just... It's an atrocity as bad as just even the advertising of drugs with the glib kind of ads that we have. So two things there in case you really can't answer me on the first one.
Okay. Well, I think if you call.
Well, the settlement, no, Merck has never said we did anything wrong. In fact, Merck's position is we did nothing wrong. In fact, Vioxx doesn't cause problems. This one study that we that led us to pull the drug, well, we acted essentially out of an abundance of caution. And to your point of, you know, the involvement of university researchers, there are a lot of people who made it possible for Merck to hide the truth about Vioxx for many years, and certainly the university researchers whom they worked with were among them. I'm not actually entirely sure I understand your question about the first. I will say that after the Vioxx withdrawal, the FDA required all non-steroidal drugs to put a warning label about cardiovascular effects. A lot of people I've talked to question whether the risk is the same across all drugs. They all carry the same warning, Advil, Aleve, et cetera, and they see it as a somewhat political move by the FDA. But beyond that, it's really not a question that I'm equipped to answer. Mm-hmm. You really should talk to your doctor.
Yeah. All right. I hope that helps or at least partially answer the question. We'll go next to someone else, and this will be Urbana and line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I have several things I want to say and a question. First place, I would have liked a book better that started back further in the whole process. For instance, what was the FDA doing when this drug was approved? I mean, where were they? Were they getting paid off or what? The second is that I'm the third person in my immediate family to have fairly agonizing spinal pain. And I took Vioxx, and it, you know, back when my pain wasn't quite that bad, but it helped me enormously. And I heard when the druggist said you could have your money back and take back the pills you haven't taken. And I heard that one big pharmacy, nobody took their pills back. And so there was a whole thing there that was never taken into account. It's all very well to get indignant when you're not hurting, but there's not that many effective painkillers outside of opiates, and that's the choice. So anyway, that's the point I want to make. My question is, what was the FDA doing? And, you know, I'd really like to know more about the whole history of this thing, because did they see this research? For example. Okay, that's my question.
Okay, and an excellent question. And this obviously gets into a much longer and more complicated story that goes to the question of how it is that drugs are tested and approved. I mean, how what is the mechanism for determining that a drug is both effective and safe?
Right. And I said a minute ago in response to the previous caller that there were a lot of people who made it possible, who helped Merck to hide the truth about Vioxx. And high on that list is the FDA, which did not receive every single piece of information, certainly not as promptly as they should have. They fought Merck for a couple of years over, you know, what the studies were showing and how people should be warned. And then they did a total about face on their position and put out, you know, approved an official label. The label is sort of the official statement of the drug's risks and benefits that essentially discounted all the signs that had been seen and, you know, left it to doctors to make their own decision about how to interpret the signals from Merck's studies. I would like to say something about what you said a minute ago about, you know, the fact that Vioxx worked for a lot of people. Every cardiologist, every physician I've talked to about this has said what Merck needed to do with this drug was tell people what the risks were and let them and their doctors decide what was appropriate. And there are many, many people for whom Vioxx was fine. And I think what this story shows you is that the pharmaceutical, in this case, Merck, distorted the research, hid the research, kept people, doctors and patients, from getting information that they should have had, and a lot of people paid with their lives for that. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, is wrong.
See, that I guess I think that this is one of the really the big central questions of this story. And now, because there is so much advertising to consumers of prescription medicines, people are used to hearing those and also used to hearing a long list of side effects given that says, you know, here's this drug and it's a great thing and it's going to do this for you, but all these bad things might happen. And, you know, and with any medication, you've got to consider there is a benefit risk balance that people and their doctors have to weigh. But then that I guess that does, though, get to the question of, you know, how do you decide whether you do leave that risk up to doctors and patients and say, here, okay, it's up to you. You can figure it out. And where do you say, no, we're going to make a judgment that the risks outweigh any potential benefits, and we're going to say that it shouldn't even be available for people to have to try to make that decision?
Well, do you know that pharmaceutical companies spend more money? There's only one segment that they spend more money advertising to than consumers,
and
it's doctors.
Yeah.
Right. Yes. And so when I say they should give the right information to doctors and patients, you know, they hire doctors. They pay them huge fees to go and speak to other doctors, to go to conferences, and they call it medical education. But it's what they want people, doctors, to know. So I'm not suggesting, I mean, it is a complex issue. You are right. I'm not suggesting that you and I decide, because I don't think we're in a position to do it. I'm not even sure that the internist down the street knows, though a lot of very smart internists did notice it and did stop prescribing. They thought the drug was dangerous.
Real quick, we'll try to get one more caller. Line one, Champagne. Hello.
Yeah, back to the trial. Were you in on the jury selection? Because there's consultants on that.
No, actually, that is the one part that I was not a part of, and I regret it. I have tried to reconstruct it and describe the thinking of the plaintiffs as they chose the jury.
One last thing. I'm just maybe again we're real short on time. 30 seconds to a minute. Has this whole controversy about Vioxx, has it had any impact, particularly on the way that medicines are promoted?
I know that there was an Institute of Medicine report in a couple of years, maybe in 2006, and it suggested that there be a moratorium on television advertising in the first months. Maybe the first 6 months or a year. And I'm sorry to say that I do not remember exactly what action was taken.
Yeah. And the big impact, what has the big impact of this been on Merck?
They're doing beautifully. Their stock is up. I mean, there was a point, even while these cases were being litigated, where it was as if it had never happened.
Yeah. Well, for people who are in and around Champaign-Urbana, you will have another opportunity to hear more from our guest, Snigdha Prakash. She'll be giving a talk in the MillerCom series on this very subject, the subject of her book, All the Justice Money Can Buy. And that's this afternoon at 4 o'clock in the Knight Auditorium on the campus. That's in the Spurlock Museum. And that's open to anyone who would be interested in attending. And she will also be doing a book signing at 12:30 this afternoon in the Illini Union Bookstore. That's also on the campus on South Wright. And that is where you, if you would like, you could pick up a copy of her book, All the Justice Money Can Buy, Corporate Greed on Trial. Kaplan Publishing is the publisher. Snigdha Prakash was a reporter for National Public Radio, 1998 until 2007. And thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.